You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right. All right, so here we are. Living it day by day, you are a superstar. And that's what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of OWW Radio. I'm your host, David, and today I'm joined by Kevin Klein, the author of the soon-to-be-released book, The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Wrestling's First Black Superstar. Greg, welcome to the program, and thank you for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, first of all, congratulations on an excellent book. I myself was very excited to read it because the JYD was always a favorite of mine. He actually got me completely hooked on professional wrestling because the very first wrestling show I ever went to, he wrestled a taping of Saturday Night's Main Event in Hershey, Pennsylvania in October of 1985. I don't know if you remember that match, but that was the match that he wrestled Terry Funk. He ended up losing, but then he ended up using Funk's branding iron to pants Jimmy Hart in the middle of the ring. Remember that one?
I remember that one very well. Yeah, absolutely. The feud with Terry Funk was, I think, probably the highlight of his career in the WWF, certainly.
Yeah, and he was so over there with the crowd. And I was so mad that he lost that I had to buy a ticket to see the show the next time it came to town. And really, I've been buying tickets ever since. So a really exciting topic for me to share with you today. But why don't you tell us why the Junkyard Dog means so much to you?
Well, I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., so I grew up with the WWF, and my dad lived in Houston, Texas, so when I would go visit him for summers and for holidays, I was exposed to this whole different world of wrestling territories, primarily Mid-South Wrestling and Houston City Wrestling, which was sort of an offshoot, and it just blew me away. You know, I grew up on the sort of formula WWF shows of 5 squash matches and then one quote-unquote main event, which was like, you know, Tito Santana versus Iron Mike Sharp or Playboy Buddy Rose versus SD Jones, where it wasn't really a main event. So when I saw the Mid-South matches, I was blown away by the action, and it just really captivated me. My dad took me to see shows at the Sam Houston Coliseum, and, you know, I grew up wanting to be a professional wrestler because of it, and I didn't know the backstory at the time, but as I got older and I started to learn the business, it really fascinated me. And when my wife and I moved to New Orleans a few years ago, you know, she's a native, and we would pass by the Superdome, and I would find myself saying sort of silly things to her, like, look, honey, there's the Superdome. And she'd go, you know, I grew up here. I went to college here. I know that's the Superdome. And I'd say, no, you don't understand. That's where Junkyard Dog and Michael Hayes wrestled their famous dog collar match. You know, it drew 26,000 fans to the Superdome, which doesn't sound like a lot, you know, compared to the Saints, but it was a huge amount for, in fact, it set an indoor pro wrestling record at the time and drew a huge gate and stunned the wrestling world because nobody had heard of any of these people and really put the Junkyard Dog on the map. And, you know, she looked at me and she said this line from The Simpsons, which was, you know, I know all those words, but that sentence made no sense to me. And, you know, I said, but you've never heard of the Junkyard Dog? No. You've never heard of Mid-South Wrestling? No. You don't know how big it was at the Superdome? And she said, well, when was that? And I said, well, that match was in 1980. And she looked at me and rolled her eyes and said, you know, I was born in 1979. I was one at the time. And, you know, she's a girl. She wasn't into wrestling. But, you know, she was sort of typical of the people that I was meeting down there. And I just, you know, it kind of became this process of, wow, this is lost history. I can't believe this is lost history. Wow, you know, the Junkyard Dog was such a big hero in New Orleans. He was such a big hero in Mid-South. Wow, you know, when you think about it, what a civil rights story. What an amazing story that somebody would do this in Louisiana and Mississippi in 1979 when there was all this trouble from the backlash of the civil rights movement. Wow, somebody should really tell this story. And I think finally one of us, you know, kind of looked at the other one and said, you know, you should really tell this story. You're a writer. You were a pro wrestler. You're the one that has the insight into this. You're the one that has the passion for this. So why don't you go and do it? And, you know, that was the beginning, and that was 2010. It's been a couple of years. It's been a long journey, but I'm happy to say that the book is out, and so far getting rave reviews, knock on wood.
Well, I had a lot of the same experience as you did in that I was a WWF fan in the mid-80s, and when all these guys were coming in, like Harley Race and Ted DiBiase and Junkyard Dog, I didn't have the backstory either of what their time was in the territories. It really was, to me, also lost history, so I really enjoyed your book because it filled that in. Greg, this is not just a story about Sylvester Ritter. This book you wrote really is a story about a special era in professional wrestling and a unique city with really a troublesome past. Tell us about New Orleans as a wrestling town.
Well, one of the things that's amazing to me is that, you know, New Orleans doesn't have a big history with wrestling. And Dave Meltzer has documented this in some of his stories about the city and about Mid-South and the obituary for the Junkyard Dog, you know, 14 years ago. New Orleans did not have a big history in wrestling. It wasn't a big wrestling town before the Junkyard Dog. It has, you know, with the exception of maybe a few Monday Night Raw shows, not been a big wrestling town since the Junkyard Dog. But for about 5 years, from 79 to 84, when he was, you know, the outright sports hero in the city, it was probably the best city for wrestling. The downtown municipal auditorium, which is in, or was in, Treme, which is a section of the city that everybody knows now because of Katrina and because of the TV show on HBO. But it held about 8,000 fans, and they ran weekly matches there. And, you know, even if you don't give them a sellout every week, if you say 4 or 5,000 fans a week, you're talking about several hundred, you know, 200,000 fans or more every year for 5 years. So more than a million fans. And then you throw in 20, 25,000 three or four times a year at the Superdome. You know, you're talking about nearly 1.5 million fans over a five-year span. And I can't figure out what other wrestler in what other city has ever done that. You know, again, that would take Dave Meltzer doing some investigative reporting in the Wrestling Observer, but I just think that's an amazing fact. And, you know, the Junkyard Dog is not in the Pro Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. I think it's going to be one of those things sort of like Bob Backlund, where when people go back and examine the actual numbers and the actual history, they'll change their opinion of him somewhat and go, wow, this really was something that was remarkable for what was done. In terms of the book, I'm really gratified that people are looking at it as more than just a biography. Now, I have to admit, I wrote it sort of in tribute to Sylvester Ritter and this lost history, but I'm glad that people are looking at it as a history of Mid-South and a history of New Orleans and a history of race in the South. I went to Auburn University, which is in Alabama,
right,
and I didn't think of it at the time, but while I was there, there were struggles over, you know, what the Old South Parade. And, you know, we had probably 20% African-American population in the school, and they started to protest this parade, and that really had an effect on me. There was a big rally for gay rights at Auburn during this time, and that had an effect on me. But it really didn't dawn on me until I got out of there. One of my friends worked in Selma, Alabama, and I stood on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and, you know, I drove through Birmingham. I drove the road from Selma to Montgomery, where they did the march, you know, from Selma. And at that point, I really started to read a lot of stuff about the civil rights movement, and being in Alabama at this time, you know, 20 years later, seeing the changes, seeing what hadn't changed, it really made me think about, you know, what had gone on before me and the people that had been there before me, and it had an effect. And so I think that played into the idea of wanting to write about Sylvester Ritter and what he did for wrestling. You know, people are asking me a lot about who did he influence? And you look at a character like The Rock, who basically was portrayed, with the exception of a little bit of the Nation of Domination stuff, you know, not because of his race at all. And I think that you wouldn't have had that without a Sylvester Ritter breaking ground along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do a good job in the book talking about New Orleans and what a unique town it was, and how the territories were a part of wrestling history. And really, wrestling at this time was bringing people together in a city like New Orleans without racial tension.
I think it's amazing. I love New Orleans. My wife is from New Orleans. You know, sometimes you go out in the sticks and you get, you know, a little bit of a twang playing in your ear. But, you know, the city itself is wonderful. It's so cultural. It's so beautiful. It's definitely a melting pot, you know, from the Mardi Gras parade to the jazz festival. It is a great place to be, and it's a great place. We've left New Orleans. We've been gone about a year, and now we're starting to miss it and wish there was sort of a way for us to get back there. But like a lot of southern cities, it has a mixed history. You know, it has a bad history in a lot of ways. And Louisiana specifically has been sort of ignorant about honoring this history or portraying it honestly. there's been a, you know, from the fact that it was a port city, so therefore a lot of slaves were brought in there and traded there, to the fact that there were a lot of slave revolts, to this idea that, you know, when there were revolts against Reconstruction, it was a revolt against, you know, the right of the white plantation owners. I mean, there's just a lot of sort of shaky, questionable history there. And, you know, I feel like I did a lot of research in terms of documenting that as well, so that people had the context of what this city was. And, you know, not just New Orleans. I mean, the state of Louisiana, the state of Mississippi. You know, there are still some things that go on there that I'm sure would be sort of questionable. But if you watch a Mid-South tape from this era, 1979, 1980, 1981, and you look in the crowd, it's a mixed crowd, you know, young and old, black and white, and they're all smiling and cheering for the Junkyard Dog. And I always found that amazing about sports. Whatever team you were for that team. And you ended up forming friendships and relationships with people that, you know, 20, 30 years ago in the South never would have existed.
Yeah, this book does a good job of building that context, like you said, of the Mid-South Territory, New Orleans, and also a very central figure here in your book, Greg, of course, is Bill Watts, a good, tough promoter who, let's give him credit, right, found and developed Sylvester Ritter and turned him into the Junkyard Dog. Can you give us some background on how he became basically in charge of Mid-South?
Sure. You know, he was a superstar wrestler. He was a main event wrestler throughout the country in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. He was not the college sports hero that he was later made out to be. He went to Oklahoma University on a football wrestling scholarship, but he was, you know, essentially drummed off the team for disciplinary reasons. He didn't get along with people in authority, which I think every wrestler that ever worked for him would probably laugh at today. But he definitely rebelled against authority himself. And so when he washed out of Oklahoma, he got sort of a lifeline from some of the other Oklahoma athletes that had gone into pro wrestling, Wahoo McDaniel being one of the top ones, and Jack Briscoe, who actually went to Oklahoma State, being the other one. Wahoo McDaniel was trying to convince Bill Watts that he should become a professional wrestler. And Bill Watts said, well, pro wrestling, you know, I was an amateur wrestler. Isn't pro wrestling all fake? And Wahoo McDaniel pulled out a check. And Bill Watts, his eyes lit up. And he said, well, you know, what's that for a month of wrestling? And Wahoo said, no. And he said, well, is that for a week of wrestling? And Wahoo said, no. And he said, well, what is that check for? And Wahoo said, it's for one match. And at that point, Bill Watts knew that the money was real, and he wanted to be a professional wrestler. And the story was very similar with the Junkyard Dog and one of his friends, where he said, you know, pro wrestling, what do you do? Isn't that fake? And Junkyard Dog pulled out a bunch of $100 bills and started counting, and he said, you know, you stop me when you think this is fake.
You know, Greg, that was one of my favorite quotes in the book, and one of the times I actually did laugh out loud. I thought that was a great story. I had not heard that before.
Yeah, I love that story, and that came from Richard Johnson, who was a very good friend of Sylvester Ritter's, went to high school and college with him, and is one of the people I'm sure we'll talk about later that is building the church in Hickory, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. So Watts decided this is something he wanted to become a part of, and then next thing you know, he was wrestling, and it turned out pretty well for him.
He made the circuit. I mean, he absolutely, you know, the old school territory circuit, he went everywhere. He wrestled for the AWA, he wrestled in San Francisco, he wrestled against Bruno Sammartino in the WWWF at the time. Mm-hmm. And then finally he came back to Oklahoma and started working for Leroy McGurk, who was the territory promoter in what then was called Tri-State Wrestling Alliance. And Leroy McGurk is a crusty figure. I think that comes through in the book pretty well. I think everybody has told a lot of the same stories about him. He was NWA Junior World Heavyweight Champion. And because of that, his territory was mostly junior heavyweights, the most famous being Danny Hodge. Leroy lost sight in one eye because of a childhood disease, and then lost sight in the other eye during a bar fight that went wrong. Mm-hmm. And they never admitted that it was a bar fight, because, of course, you don't admit that a wrestler could lose a fight. That was, like, taboo in those days. But, you know, he probably now you would diagnose him as, you know, depressed or having post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, back in the day, they just thought he was an SOB or an alcoholic or whatever whatever people thought of him. You know, I mean, I say that lightly, but I also say that with all due respect. I mean, he obviously was a person who had a hard life at times. He was not the best promoter. I mean, by the time Bill Watts got there, he was sort of losing his grip on the business. And I guess that happens a lot to people who the business had passed them by. He became sort of bitter. He became moody. And so even though Bill Watts came back in, they had a lot of conflicts over running the business. And Bill Watts was such a big star at that point in time that he became part owner of the territory in exchange for, you know, basically a step down in terms of coming back to Oklahoma from New York or San Francisco or Chicago, wherever he was wrestling at the time. And because of that, they had a, you know, sort of butted heads quite a bit over the years. One of the final breaks between the two of them was over this idea of featuring a black or African-American wrestler as the star of the show. And I think that, you know, it's possible that the Junkyard Dog wouldn't have been the Junkyard Dog had Leroy McGurk and Bill Watts stayed together. But instead they split up, Bill Watts formed Mid-South Wrestling, and the rest sort of is history. You know, Bill Watts was successful, and Leroy McGurk ended up losing his territory because of the differences of opinion.
It's a really good part of the book where you describe the search, though, for that black superstar. Bill Watts wanted a black superstar, but there wasn't just one sitting there that he knew would become a breakout star. They couldn't find the right guy. Go through some of the guys that they considered before they got to Sylvester Ritter.
Well, I think the guys that existed before Sylvester Ritter were probably, for the most part, too big of stars to come in for this territory that was essentially, you know, Oklahoma to Louisiana and back. I mean, Bobo Brazil obviously was the forefounder. And, you know, he was, as we say in the book, the Jackie Robinson in terms of professional wrestling.
Right.
He was a huge star. He ended up being a headliner for 5 decades.
Yep.
You know, I've had some people online sort of snipe at me about the title of the book, you know, how the Junkyard Dog became pro wrestling's first black superstar. And they say, well, you know, aren't you aware of Bobo Brazil? And it's like, of course we're aware of Bobo Brazil. You know, there wouldn't have been a Rock without Sylvester Ritter. There wouldn't have been a Junkyard Dog without Bobo Brazil. I mean, he was a legend. And, you know, rightly enshrined in every pro wrestling hall of fame that there is. Now, at the time, he was, I think, in his 60s.
Right.
So he probably would not have been a great choice. He had a restaurant in Michigan where he lived. And he was wrestling, you know, essentially part-time for Dick the Bruiser in the remnants of the Indianapolis territory.
Yeah, he just wasn't the right guy for Watts at this time.
Wasn't the right guy, wasn't the right time. And I think probably the same thing existed with Sailor Art Thomas, who, you know, not only was sort of in Bobo Brazil's shadow, but really was a forerunner of the great physiques. And I think, I can't swear to this, but he actually did it without the steroids as opposed to a lot of the later physiques. You know, he was also a big star. Like Bobo Brazil, he would tour and wrestle Buddy Rogers for the NWA title back in the day. But again, by that point, in his 60s, winding down his career, just not the right guy. Probably couldn't afford him, just like Bobo Brazil. You know, Rocky Johnson was the next guy that came along, father of the Rock, really my first favorite wrestler from the time that he came into the WWF in 1982, 1983. He was very charismatic. He was a pretty good worker compared to some of the other guys that were on the list. But again, he was a national headliner at that point in time. Rocky Johnson started working for the WWF in 1982. So even if he had come into Mid-South, he probably would have jumped pretty early, as most of the wrestlers did in that era,
right,
when they took the deal to go national. But I don't think the Mid-South could have afforded him at that point in time anyway. I mean, he was in his mid-40s. Obviously, he had a family to support. He was a big headliner most everywhere he went. It really would have been a step down for him to come to Tulsa, and, you know, even if it was to be the headliner. You know, Tony Atlas was the next guy on the list, but Tony Atlas literally was working for the WWF in 1979, 1980, and he was having not a headline run, but sort of a semi-main event run. I mean, he was in the semi-main event in the famous show at Shea Stadium where Larry Zbysko and Bruno Sammartino met.
Yep.
And so at that point in time, you're not going to leave New York City to go to Tulsa. So even though Tony Atlas did come into Mid-South in 1982, it was the wrong time for him to come in 1979. So I think at that point, that really left them with the idea of trying to create their own star, which I think appealed to Bill Watts quite a bit. That was what Bill Watts liked to do as a booker or as a promoter. And they knew of Sylvester Ritter. He had come through the territory at one point. He had gone up to Calgary with Grizzly Smith's son, Jake Roberts. So they knew that he was out there, and I think that they thought that they could groom him and make him what they wanted, even though he wasn't a great worker, never would be a great worker. But he was pretty good on interviews. He had a good physique at the time, and obviously he had a lot of charisma. And, you know, that's what did it. That sort of got it over.
I enjoy the stories about his time in Stampede up in Calgary. I always found that territory to be pretty interesting. And when he came back to Mid-South, like you said, it was the right time, the right person for Bill Watts to develop. I give him a lot of credit for that. Renamed him the Junkyard Dog, and really the character took off from there. It changed a little bit over time, right? But it didn't take long for him to really catch on.
No, it was pretty quick. I think that, you know, originally it was a little bit more like a Sanford and Son. Literally, they took the name the Junkyard Dog seriously and tried to have him wheel out a wheelbarrow full of junk. But that didn't last. It just became, you know, this guy with a chain. And I think the music played a big role, obviously. Another One Bites the Dust. They programmed him, you know, somebody said online, much like he did with Goldberg, you know, 20 years later. He basically won all his matches against all the top heels in just a minute or so and beat everybody with his finishing maneuver, which was the thump. And that was right at the beginning of this era of a finishing maneuver, quote-unquote. You know, you've probably seen some of the matches from the 60s and 70s as well. And, you know, a lot of times guys would win a match with a body slam or an arm bar or something like that. So
right.
I think this was the beginning of really having a big specialty maneuver. And so that got over. You know, the music and the specialty maneuver and the winning the matches so quickly and being really good on interviews, it just all came together. And, you know, as the book talks about and as you've talked about, this idea of having a black superstar in the South, but in an area, this wasn't the Appalachians. This was an area where the population was 30 to 40% African American. And finally see one of their own as the top star really got over. And then, of course, because Sylvester was so good at what he did and so charismatic, it got over with everybody, and he became everybody's hero.
Mid-South just caught fire, and especially in New Orleans. Of course, the downtown municipal auditorium became known as the Dog's Yard. And tell us, Greg, the story about how there's confusion over the origins of the Who Dat saying, because, you know, if you're a football fan, you always think it's with the New Orleans Saints.
Well, you know, there has been a lot written, especially with the Saints winning the Super Bowl a few years ago, about the legend of Who Dat. And it goes back quite a ways. I mean, it actually goes back almost to the turn of the 20th century, where it started in a poem, and it became picked up on vaudeville. There was a Groucho Marx movie about, you know, Who Dat Man. There was a couple of different songs. It was really something that has existed in black culture for a long time. And in the 1970s, it was used quite a bit for football chants. And one of the teams was using it at the Superdome in, I think it was 1979, when they won the state championship. It was, I believe, the Patterson Lumberjacks. And they beat John Curtis, which was a huge powerhouse team from New Orleans, for the state championship. And so they were chanting, who dat think they're going to beat them Jacks?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't swear to it. It's not scientific, but I think that that's probably where it started to get picked up in New Orleans. And then, you know, the next year, Junkyard Dog became a big hero in the Superdome, in the downtown municipal auditorium. And I think that people started, you know, organically started to cheer that for the Junkyard Dog. They didn't actually start using it for the Saints until 1983, when they had an uncharacteristic, really strong start to the year. So, you know, again, you can't actually prove it, but the idea that it started for the Junkyard Dog in 79 or 80 and started for the Saints in 1983 in the same building, I think that it's conceivable to think that it kind of got passed along that way. You know, the New Orleans paper has been in the news lately for their cutbacks and going to 3 days a week, the Times-Picayune. They ran a very impressive article about this. You know, it was on the front page, and it had a full jump page on all these origins about, you know, the Who Dat chant, and they didn't mention Junkyard Dog. I felt so bad. I felt angry. I wrote him, you know, the writer, his name is Dave Walker. Good writer, nice guy, has done an amazing job chronicling the Treme series and all the references in Treme. But, you know, he was a little snippy about this idea about, you know, missing the Junkyard Dog and the history. And I think that I was not the only one that wrote him. I got the impression that a 100 people had written him to tell him that no, really, they were the ones who started this who dat chant, and don't you know about this high school from 1964, and, you know, don't you know about this song from, you know, 1981, and somebody actually trademarked the term who dat. And it's been the subject of some lawsuits since the Saints, you know, have gotten good again.
Hmm.
You know, the Saints are called the Who Dat Nation now. So it is as big a part of the culture in New Orleans now as Mardi Gras or Jazz Fest or anything else.
Well, at this point in time, Bill Watts had his star, but it was very important to book him correctly. In your book, Greg, you talk about how JYD was not a good worker. Some of the ways that Bill Watts booked him correctly, for example, was matches were kept short. Nobody ever saved the JYD when he was getting attacked. And if, you know, if he ever lost, he would eventually gain revenge at super shows. Kind of talk about how JYD was booked by Bill Watts and how hard it was for him to find people to wrestle against the Junkyard Dog.
Well, I would say it was crucial. I think that it's been proven again and again and again that if you take a hero that's the quote-unquote ethnic hero and you don't book him to be a superstar, he's not a big draw. I mean, look at WCW and the way that they tried to book the Mexican wrestlers. And then they threw their hands up and said, well, we don't know why we're not drawing Hispanic fans. It's the problem with wrestlers. Well, it wasn't the problem with the wrestlers. It was the problem with the booking. And to work backwards, I mean, that's the problem that Bill Watts had with Butch Reed.
Mm-hmm.
He kept booking, you know, Hacksaw Duggan to save Butch Reed, and then they blamed Butch Reed because Butch Reed didn't get over. You know, with Sylvester Ritter, they did it right, and it's amazing that they did it right that time and couldn't do it right again.
Right.
This idea that no one could save the Junkyard Dog, I think that was a big part of the formula. And, yeah, you're right. They had to get the right workers in there. If you look at the attendance figures and you look at the business, the lowest point in the Junkyard Dog's 5 years in Mid-South is when he's wrestling Kamala and King Kong Bundy.
Mm-hmm.
Because those were guys that were bigger than him. Those were guys that were worse at working than him. I mean, his good matches, if you want to use the term good matches, but his most famous matches, his most famous feuds, his longest feuds are against guys that were sterling workers. Ted DiBiase obviously was a stellar worker. Mr. Olympia, Jerry Stubbs, was a very good worker. Paul Orndorff was a good worker. Butch Reed was a very underrated worker. He was very good at making movement against the Junkyard Dog, selling for the Junkyard Dog. In the end, when they put him in with Buddy Landell was great at, you know, looking like he was just getting brutalized by the Junkyard Dog. And probably the most famous workers were the Midnight Express.
Yeah.
For the last Stampede feud. Junkyard Dog was at sort of the end of his peak in terms of Mid-South. He was out of shape. He was not going to be in the ring for much of the match because he was going to take the hot tag. And again, you know, every time they deviated from that formula, things went bad. Attendance fell and the matches weren't very good. And, you know, the feud with Kamala was a mess and the feud with King Kong Bundy wasn't very good. But every time they went back to the formula really worked. You know, in terms of not letting the Junkyard Dog get beat, you know, letting him make his own comeback. The second that they put him in a match with Mr. Wrestling 2 and it went wrong and it looked like he was beat by someone who didn't deserve to beat him, that killed New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that knee lift that missed, essentially, and Junkyard Dog went down and lost the North American title to Mr. Wrestling 2, you know, within a couple of months, they moved out of the downtown municipal auditorium and the crowds were gone. You know, they came back a little bit to the Lakefront Arena for good feuds, but it was not the same crowd. It was a very different crowd after that.
Mm-hmm. That story with Mr. Wrestling, too, is fascinating. But moving backwards a little bit, even though he did struggle, of course, with matches with Kamala and King Kong Bundy, and if he was in there with the wrong worker, it was a problem. The match with Michael Hayes, that dog collar match you mentioned earlier, the feud with the Fabulous Freebirds, that was booking at its best, especially at how you had to book Junkyard Dog.
Well, I think that Michael Hayes is sort of the unsung hero of that in terms of the fact that he was a talker. He wasn't a worker either, but he would make you hate him. And from what I understand, he's, you know, still very good at that, only now he's in a management position and he's angering the wrestlers with his booking or his stories about what a big star he was back in the day or, you know, whatever it is that he likes to talk about in the bar every night. But he was, you know, he was the type of guy that you wanted to get your hands on. And he was just, I think, small enough. You know, he was a tall guy, but he wasn't, you know, built or anything like that. He was just rough enough looking that I think a lot of fans probably thought that they could get their hands on him. And, you know, it's pretty amazing, especially as vicious as some of the Mid-South fans were and some of the stories are that, you know, somebody didn't get Michael Hayes during that period. But it was a great idea, this idea of blinding somebody. It had worked, obviously, in a couple of other places, most famously in California with Freddie Blassie. Mm-hmm. And this idea that they had ruined the Junkyard Dog's career. And then, as luck would have it, his daughter, LaToya, was born during this angle, and they were selling to the fans that, you know, the Junkyard Dog would never be able to wrestle again. He would have to find a new way to support his family. And, you know, that's one of the things that really amazed me, this idea that the fans took it upon themselves to send money to the Mid-South offices, you know, what equaled thousands of dollars. I mean, and it was in small amounts. You know, that's one of the things that has definitely inspired me to try to do some things to honor Sylvester Ritter. If his fans were going to, you know, send a dollar or send $5 or send $20 to the Mid-South offices for, you know, I mean, they believed it was real, but what was a wrestling angle, I just think that's so amazing.
Well, certainly there was a meteoric rise for the Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, but we have to tell the other part of this story as well, and that he really started to live this lavish lifestyle. He was making a lot of money, and with it became the trappings of fame, and he really couldn't handle his success, could he?
No, I guess he couldn't. You know, I've tried in talking to his friends and you know, writing the book, I've tried to stay away from the National Enquirer angle, so to speak, but you can't really get away from it. I mean, this was a man who was a shooting star. You know, for better for worse, he was a huge star for about 10 years, and he ate or snorted his way out of the business, you know, however you want to look at it.
Yeah.
And it's sad. I mean, it really is sad. He's a guy that could, you know, were he still alive, not that he would be main eventing, but, you know, Bobo Brazil was at this age. You know, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair still can get a main event if they want to go out and wrestle. And he was that level of a superstar. And, you know, I mean, he died in a car accident. You can't blame that on the drugs or the fall from grace. It could happen to anybody, especially in wrestling when you spend so much time on the road. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the idea that he lost his career, the idea that he, you know, was no longer getting booked, the idea that he was working for an auto repossession company, you know, had had three or four divorces, had, you know, really was living with a family, didn't have a place of his own. I mean, all of that is pretty sad.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not pretty sad. It's sad. It's tragic that somebody could rise so high and then fall so far. And it's, you know, it's a common story. One of the things that I'm amazed about in wrestling is how, for lack of a better term, cutting edge it is in terms of drug use. You know, and it's awful. I don't say this lightly, but I'm always amazed. Whatever drug you read in the news that the kids are doing or, you know, people have just discovered, wrestlers seem to be, you know, several years ahead of them and ahead of the news stories in terms of that. Hmm. I mean, stories of wrestlers using GHB or, you know, some other form of animal tranquilizers or, you know, if you remember the movie with Jake Roberts where he's smoking crack.
Right.
Or, you know, I mean, the cocaine use or whatever it was, you know, that was popular or became popular at that point in time. I'm sure the wrestlers are, you know, snorting bath salts or whatever it is that's been in the news these days lately as causing all these psychotic breaks. And it's sad. And on some level, I guess you understand that the road is lonely. There's not a lot to do when you're not wrestling. You're away from your family. A lot of these guys lose their family, you know, because of their own actions in terms of, you know, cheating on their wives or in terms of the hard reality of being on the road all the time. So I do understand that there are a lot of reasons that people turn to these activities, but, you know, it's sad. And it always bothered me how many wrestling deaths there were. I know that it bothers people inside the business or people that are fans of the business. It bothers me that no one else seems to care. And, you know, Sylvester Ritter essentially lost his career because of this. And, you know, I don't want to pretend that he didn't do it to himself. You know, everybody is responsible for their own actions, and he's responsible for losing his career. It's not something that somebody else made him do. It's not, you know, oh, poor Sylvester Ritter, it was his choices in life that did that. But it's still tragic. And it, from a fan perspective, to watch it, it is sad. And, you know, in writing the book, it's something that I shook my head about all the time. When I was interviewing people at Fayetteville State University, which is his alma mater, I came out, and it was August, and it was a hot day, and I was turning on the car to get the air conditioning going, and, you know, the radio came on, and I think it's a Bob Seger song about, you know, don't you know that you are a shooting star?
Wow.
And I just thought, you know, that's it. That's what Sylvester Ritter was. And, you know, on some level, it's what makes the story poignant. I mean, if it ever becomes a movie or something like that, it's part of what will sell the movie. It's, you know, it's like the Al Jolson story or something. But it's also, obviously, on a human level, it's really sad. His family is without him. You know, I mean, he didn't leave behind a big legacy. They say that his grave is unmarked because they didn't have money to you know, buy a gravestone.
Wow.
So in that respect, it's just a tragedy.
But I'm glad you talked about it in the book because I thought you gave it very fair and balanced coverage. You certainly didn't, like you said, go into the National Enquirer sensations of it, but it is a part of his overall story as a professional wrestler. So I am glad you talked about it. But let's talk about when he moved on then to work for Vince in the World Wrestling Federation 1984. It had a huge impact on his career because he became this huge national star, and they did a pretty good job marketing him in the WWF. But what I found interesting was it did not completely sink Mid-South right away.
No, I think that if anything, 1984 and 1985 probably were the best years in Mid-South wrestling. Maybe financially, 84 was a better year. On some level, 1985 was a great year in terms of the in-ring product and the formula that they had. I think Hacksaw Duggan was ready to go as the replacement in terms of Mid-South. And it's funny, you look at Duggan, and I know his book came out recently, and you look at the Junkyard Dog, and, you know, one of the things that struck me when I was writing this book was that if you just look at the end of their careers, you know, Duggan in WCW and Dog in the WWF, you would not understand why we're talking about them. I mean,
right.
they were not good at the end. They were over the hill. They, you know, drugs had eaten them up. I don't know what the case was with Duggan. I don't want to say something that's not true, but, you know, I mean, they were resting on their laurels, so to speak. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily get it, but if you saw them in Mid-South, you would get it. I mean, they just were incredible performers. And, you know, Mid-South went on for a couple of years with great success. You know, obviously what killed them ultimately was this idea that they were a, you know, regional territory and the business was changing. And Bill Watts got a clue, but unfortunately he got a clue just a little bit too late, like most of the other promoters, about what Vince was doing and what cable was doing to the business and how you could go national. You know, in terms of the WWF in 1984, one of the things that I like to point to is that, you know, the Junkyard Dog was probably the second biggest babyface in the WWF at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Snuka was on his way down. Andre the Giant was still thought of as this, you know, sort of special event guy. You know, for house shows in 1984, even into 1985, when they had a B show or a C show, it was usually the Junkyard Dog that was headlining that show. And it was usually against Greg Valentine for the Intercontinental title. Later on, I think he wrestled Randy Savage a little bit for the Intercontinental title, where it was teaming with Ricky Steamboat or Tito Santana for the tag team titles, you know, to challenge for the tag team titles. If you look at the cartoon, I mean, he's one of the featured wrestlers on the cartoon. If you look at the record that they put out, you know, his Grab Them Cakes. Yeah, that was one of the big songs that they pushed off of that album. I think they released it as a single. I don't know how it did, but, you know, he was on the first Saturday Night Main Event, wrestling Pete Doherty. You know, he was featured in the first WrestleMania. He was featured in the second WrestleMania. I mean, you know, in the Observer, they said that his match with Tito Santana against the Funks was the best match on WrestleMania 2. So, you know, he did have a steep decline, but it's also worth pointing out that the first couple of years for him were really good, at least in terms of, you know, in-ring and being one of the top performers and being one of the stars of the show. Now, you know, he was there too long, or he was, you know, his career started to fall off. He didn't save his money wisely. He didn't do some of the things he probably should have done in terms of training. you know, by the end, he was just kind of another guy, and he got fired in 1989. But, you know, you look back and you think, wow, he was there for 5 years, and for two or three of them, he really was one of the headliners.
Oh, no question. Well, one of my favorite memories of his is when he won the Wrestling Classic. That's really one of the very first shows I remember watching, of course, the first pay-per-view, as it was at the time. And I was really into it. He won the final of that tournament, of course, over Randy Savage by countout. It was a big moment for me as a kid. One of the points in your book that I found very interesting was how Vince, though, made him start acting more dog-like, became more of a caricature, even in the interviews, and he was barking. And people that didn't see his work in Mid-South, that's not exactly how it was played there, right?
No. You know, I have a lot of respect for Vince McMahon. I always want to couch what I say about Vince McMahon. I've had no contact with them. I don't know that they'll ever offer me a job, or I don't know if I would take it or anything like that. But, you know, I don't necessarily share some of his ideas about booking. And, you know, he's a genius. I mean, all props to him. It's I'm nobody in this business except a writer that wrote a book. He's the guy that transformed wrestling. So I want to be very clear about that. I'm not saying this in a critical way of him. I'm just talking about my own personal taste. I don't love his use of character. I don't love his ideas about booking. I guess I'm becoming old school. I like the wrestling action. I don't want to make it a TV show, or, you know, I wasn't a big fan of Tuesday Night Titans and all those skits and things like that. I really did like the wrestling action and the storylines in the ring. And, you know, one of the things that they tried to do with these characters is sort of overemphasize them and make them caricatures rather than characters. And, you know, to me, it always sort of exposed the business. I know how old school I sound when I say that. I mean, they probably laugh if they ever heard me say that, because they didn't care about exposing the business. But, you know, when the Junkyard Dog switched from using the thump, or he still used the thump, but one of his big setup maneuvers was getting down on all fours like a dog and barking and crawling into a headbutt, you know, and I just thought, okay, there's no way that that would actually hurt somebody. My stepfather used to love to bother me about, you know, wrestling's fake, you know, wrestling's fake, you know, wrestling's fake. And I think that was about the point where, you know, there was no comeback to him. You know, the Junkyard Dog is headbutting somebody while he crawls. And there really wasn't any way to say, no, that really hurt the guy. Because clearly it was not really hurting the guy. And, you know, the thing about the interviews, I guess, that bothered people is that, you know, Sylvester Ritter in the early years as the Junkyard Dog was a little bit like Ernie Ladd. He could get out there and he would howl or he would bark a little bit. You know, he was in character, but he was also so thoughtful and so well-spoken. And I don't even know, like, where the racial line is, where the stereotype line is about saying something like that. It makes me a little uncomfortable. But, you know, those were really the interviews that he gave. They were good interviews by wrestling terms. You know, take everything else out of it. He was a good talker. He was good at getting people to come see the matches and to want to see the show. And in the WWF, it was much, much more on the line of sort of good taste or bad taste, if you want. And as I point out in the book, they didn't just do it to him. I mean, they did it to Hacksaw Duggan, and they did it to Dusty Rhodes, and, you know, they called Dory Funk Jr. Hoss, and, you know, they did all sorts of things that sort of offended the sensibilities of old-school wrestling fans and territory wrestling fans, and they still do. You know, they still make it seem like, you know, they were the only wrestling federation ever, and all of that. But, you know, in terms of the Junkyard Dog, they definitely changed his character a little bit, and I know that it didn't sit well with a lot of people, and, you know, it kind of, in retrospect, didn't sit well with me.
Yeah. You can't tell the whole story of the Junkyard Dog without talking about what happened after he left the WWF. As you said, he was fired after WrestleMania 4. He was a participant in that Battle Royal. Actually, made it near to the end of the match there. He did come back several times to work for WCW, certainly less than rave reviews, and was not really an impact player there.
Well, you know, he did have couple of main events. I mean, he wrestled in the main event against Ric Flair in, I think, 1990 at one of the Clash of the Champions. Mm-hmm. That was when Ole Anderson was trying to, you know, recreate the magic and find a black superstar to bring back fans. And, you know, that clearly didn't work. You know, he wrestled in one of the semi-main events of the Great American Bash just after that with the Dudes with Attitudes against the Horsemen. And, you know, that really didn't work either. I found it amazing. I mean, I think if you think back to that year, which was a fairly awful year for WCW, I know they all sort of blur together as bad years now, but the idea that Ric Flair had a feud with this guy, El Gigante, who couldn't do any wrestling moves. I mean, they taught him a suplex, and you know, he was 7 foot whatever, and he, you know, he stared at the camera and he said, "I want to belch." And that's all he could do. And Ric Flair had a whole feud with him, but the Wrestling Observer named his feud with the Junkyard Dog as the worst feud of the year. So that pretty much speaks volumes for how bad things were. And, you know, the book on Ric Flair is that he could have a good match with anybody, right? He could have a great match with a broomstick. That's what they used to always say about Ric Flair. But he couldn't have a good match with Sylvester Ritter in 1990. And, you know, that certainly speaks for how far he fell. Obviously, they didn't draw. Obviously, the feud, you know, didn't turn into this big run around the South, and it didn't draw black fans to the arenas, and it didn't save Ole Anderson's job. And what was amazing is that they kept trying to do it. You know, they kept bringing him back, and but it got worse and worse. And, you know, the last time he was wrestling in six-man tags with Tommy Rich and Ricky Morton, and, you know, after both of those guys had sort of fallen from grace as well. And even that didn't end up working out. I'm pretty sure that he got fired from that as well. And, you know, when they went back to New Orleans and they thought, oh, okay, we'll bring back the Junkyard Dog and Butch Reed and try to recreate the magic. And it's amazing to me that Michael Hayes was doing color commentary for that match. And he said, you know, I used to hold the record for attendance in this building, but it looks like that record might fall today. Meanwhile, 1,000 fans had paid to see those matches. And, you know,
that's a great story in that book.
They papered the crowd and they got, I don't know, 5,000 people in the building. And that was to see a main event of Ricky Steamboat versus Ric Flair.
Yeah.
You know, they put some old Mid-South matches on the card as well. Bob Orton versus Dick Murdoch and Junkyard Dog versus Butch Reed. But, you know, nobody cared. And, you know, the way that Dave Meltzer represented it is that Junkyard Dog had missed like 9 shows in a row before that date, and, you know, they would have fired him months ago, except that they really thought they needed him to draw a crowd in New Orleans. And here they were, this 1989, and it was so 5 years after he and Butch Reed had last, you know, headlined the Superdome. And that last match, when they headlined in the summer of 1984, just before he jumped to the WWF, they drew like 21,000 fans. And, you know, they came back 5 years later and they were forgotten and nobody cared. And, you know, that's sad. I mean, I definitely think that's sad. And to think that in 1992, Bill Watts was still calling him up, you know, after almost 8 years of not speaking to one another and asking him if he wanted to give it another go. And, you know, when they met, Bill Watts determined that there was just no way it was going to work. You think about Bill Watts and his history with wanting to recreate, you know, the magic, and for him to take a look at Sylvester Ritter and say he's not there anymore, that's a pretty profound statement, I would think.
Well, you detail in the book about how it was hard to find the Junkyard Dog. It was certainly hard to replace him, and Bill Watts did try several times.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think the quote got cut or sort of changed from the book, but, you know, what I said originally was it was a foolproof plan, except that it worked so badly that you wonder who the fool was and why he didn't understand the plan. I mean, Bill Watts tried again and again and again, but he never really got it right. And, you know, I was a big Butch Reed fan. I think that Butch Reed might have worked had they done it correctly. But as I said earlier, instead of programming Butch Reed to never need anybody to save him, they continuously had Hacksaw Duggan save him. And instead of making Butch Reed beat everybody within a minute, you know, they had him lose to Kamala within about a month of you know, his babyface turn. And of course they had him destroyed by George Wells, you know, a month earlier. So they really did not do it very well with Butch Reed. And then, you know, he left and they brought him back like 3 months later and tried again. And they put him in a main event with Ric Flair, and it actually drew about 16,000 fans to the Superdome. So, you know, my feeling is it wasn't Butch Reed, it was the booking. But beyond that, everybody else that they tried, whether it was George Wells or the Snowman or Savannah Jack, or, you know, even Ron Simmons down the line. I mean, none of these guys had the it factor. And if you want to say it was charisma, I'd probably be inclined to agree. You know, the idea that you could just take any black man off the street because he had big muscles and you could teach him a few wrestling holds, which is what they seemed to do with a couple of these guys. And, you know, the fans were going to react. You know, people ask me a lot, was Bill Watts a racist? Was he not a racist? Was he revolutionary? Was he, you know, one of those guys who didn't see color? I don't know the answer to that. I always say I don't know what was in the man's heart. I know what he did in the ring in terms of, you know, successfully promoting African-American wrestlers, and I know what he did in terms of not successfully promoting them. But when you look at the Snowman or you look at Savannah Jack and you think, well, they really thought that this guy was going to be the new Junkyard Dog just because he was, you know, a steroided up black guy, that's the part that kind of makes you question it, you know?
Right. Yeah, and there's some good detail in the book about how Mid-South then came to be the Universal Wrestling Federation in 1986, and you know how that era of national expansion really signaled the end of Bill Watts there in Mid-South. And he's such a fascinating character that you weave throughout this whole book.
He is a character. I think that's a great way of putting it. He's a contradiction on so many levels as to whether he was a good guy or an SOB, probably a little bit of both. Was he a great wrestler? Yeah. Was he a great promoter? He was a great promoter in terms of the product. I don't know if he was a great person to work for. You know, as Jake Roberts said, there's going to be a long line of people waiting to go to the bathroom on his grave when he dies, because there were a lot of people that he bullied or intimidated or punched or you know, the story that he wrote in his book about, you know, fighting people back in the day and ripping out eyeballs. I mean, who knows if that's true, but, you know, I mean, he was somebody who just had a lot of issues himself, and obviously that played out during his time in wrestling. But on the other hand, he did some amazing things, and, you know, Mid-South Wrestling, I think, still stands up when you watch the tape as to how good it is. You know, it's funny you mentioned the UWF. I was a huge fan in 1986. I can't go back and watch the UWF now just because it, like, signals the beginning of the end to me. You know, I liked the Mid-South. I liked the matches in Shreveport. You know, I liked the twang. You know, I liked the regionalness of it. When I look at their attempts to go national now, I just kind of shake my head and go, wow, that was no longer what it was that I liked. And that was too bad that they lost that when they were trying to compete with Vince and with the NWA.
The last point on Bill Watts is a great quote in the book, my favorite actually, when he said, the JYD doesn't get paid by the hour. It's such an interesting view into how he booked the Junkyard Dog and how he really got him over. I love that. The JYD doesn't get paid by the hour.
Yeah, he should have trademarked that phrase. I think that was, you know, of all the things that Bill Watts said over and over and over again, I think that was probably one of the smartest ones. And really spoke to how he got over the Junkyard Dog, because here were all these wrestlers that the top baby faces in the Federation would have problems with, and then Junkyard Dog would come in and beat them in 30 seconds or a minute with the big thump, and that was it.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that's kind of textbook how you do it. I mean, you could get anybody on here that was a booker back in the day, and they would just shake their heads and say, yeah, that's it. That's what you want to do for a guy.
Now, sadly, the Junkyard Dog passed away on June 2nd, 1998, driving back from his daughter's graduation. To me, it's remarkable that the New Orleans Times-Picayune completely missed the story.
I'm amazed by that. I think that, you know, all of us that love wrestling or loved wrestling or have been associated with wrestling shake our heads at how disrespected it is, and maybe that's part of the fault of the people in wrestling for, you know, the old school mentality, you know, not wanting the publicity or, you know, the lies that they would tell about the business or the lies that they would tell about themselves. But, you know, I hate that there's this lost history aspect to it. And I hate that it doesn't get covered. I hate that nobody looks at the deaths. Nobody cares about the steroids. You know, I mean, they don't even care. People don't even care about steroids in baseball half the time. You hear a lot of people say, oh, well, nobody cares about that. Why are we even talking about the steroids? So if they don't care in baseball, I guess they're not going to care in wrestling. But, you know, it does bother me. And it bothers me that it takes somebody like Randy Savage, who transcended the sport in terms of, you know, everybody knew who Randy Savage was. So when he dies, there's some national publicity. But You know, short of that, or short of a horrible tragedy like Owen Hart or, you know, Chris Benoit, there's just no coverage of what goes on in terms of the underside of the business or the sad aspect of the business or even the success of the business. And so it did bother me that the Times-Picayune never, you know, to this day. I mean, I don't know if they'll cover the book. You know, we're trying to get them to cover the book. I don't know if they will. I don't know if any of the news outlets in New Orleans will cover the book. I hope they do. We're reaching out and we're hoping to get some publicity, but you know, people's mentality is, oh, that's just wrestling. Isn't it fake? And it's pretty amazing that what has it been, like 25 years since Vince went in front of the commission in New Jersey and said, no, it's choreographed, it's entertainment, it's not legitimate. And still, when you talk to people about wrestling and you try to get them to cover it as, you know, actual entertainment, and their reaction still is, but that's wrestling, isn't it fake? So it's pretty well ingrained in people's psyches that, you know, all of this working, quote unquote, that old school wrestling did. And, you know, now it's working against them, you know, so to speak. So that's that. And I wish that there was more coverage. And I'm hoping, you know, that we'll get some things out there about Sylvester Ritter and we'll get some publicity and at least get him remembered. I know from walking the streets of New Orleans that people remember him when you bring him up. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that, you know, if we bring him up enough times, there'll be a little bit of a tribute in his honor.
Well, of course, JYD is the member of the WWE Hall of Fame, inducted in 2004. Some good news is that here in 2012, he will be an inductee into the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in Amsterdam, New York.
Yeah, they just did that. I was really tickled to see that. And I thought that they might. I knew that they were kind of a few years behind everybody else in terms of their inductions. They only do a couple at a time. And, you know, they just did Ted DiBiase last year. They just did Ernie Ladd a few years ago. So clearly they were not like the Observer or the WWE where they were just in a rush to get everybody, all the big names in, you know. And this is more of an actual physical building, which is kind of cool, I think. Sort of off the beaten path. I hope people are actually going and you know, seeing the actual wrestling artifacts and things like that. But it's cool that they have this induction weekend and, you know, they're inducting some legends. And, you know, as we talk about, it is such lost history that it's nice to see that there are people out there, you know, on the web and these wrestling shows and, you know, the Hall of Fame that actually do care about this history.
Yeah. And you yourself really trying to secure JYD's place and his impact in not only New Orleans history, but in professional wrestling history. I know you've written letters to several states to get him inducted into their state Hall of Fames. Greg, I wanted to ask you, in researching this book and in writing this book, what did you personally learn?
Well, one of the things that I learned is about Sylvester Ritter as a man, as a human being. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so easy to look at these guys that are larger than life, that are may or may not be on drugs, that, you know, may or may not be acting like wild, crazy teenage boys out there on the road, and just think that they're, you know, performers, or they're lucky, or they're not lucky, or, you know, whatever you would think. But what I learned is that this was really a human being, you know, that grew up in North Carolina during a very racist time, that dealt with things like the Klan, you know, that dealt with the integration of his high school, that, you know, played football, was a really good football player, was a pretty good wrestler, and you know, I think he competed in field events and track and field. You know, I learned that this was a very controversial decision to make him the star of Mid-South, and that it had never been done before, and that even though there had been some wrestlers like Bobo Brazil that had wrestled in main events, you know, that had held titles, you know, nobody had ever really thought to make a pro wrestler the star of an entire territory. Mm-hmm. And you know, the idea that they did it in Louisiana and Mississippi, that kind of blew me away. And it still does. I think it always will on some level. And so that's what I learned. And, you know, again, I learned that he was a huge star in New Orleans in an area that never supported wrestling and really hasn't supported wrestling since then.
Yeah.
And I learned that the city had such a love affair with him that, you know, for a time anyway, he was a bigger star than the big sports stars of the day.
Now, you yourself started an Indiegogo campaign to raise $1,000 in Sylvester Ritter's name for the GS Glory Church in Hickory, North Carolina. Tell us a little bit more about that and where people can go to check out and donate to that good cause.
Absolutely. It's www.indiegogo.com/junkyarddog. Indie, like the wrestling, go-go, G-O-G-O. www.indiegogo.com/junkyarddog. You know, one of the things that I wanted to do along the way was honor the memory of Sylvester Ritter and honor this character that he created, the Junkyard Dog. And I sort of ended up working backwards. I mean, my first thought was that they really need to do a statue in the Louis Armstrong Park in Treme, near where the downtown municipal auditorium was. And I thought about starting a charity, you know, and going through that. But legally, I just didn't know if I could handle the framework for that and making my whole life about it. But I really did want to end up doing something. And, you know, I hope that as the book takes off and as things go on, we will work our way around back to the Louis Armstrong Park, because I absolutely think that he should be honored there. I think that he's as big a cultural hero in New Orleans as anybody. Mm-hmm. But when I was doing interviews for the book, one of the things that I discovered was that his friend Richard Johnson, who I talked about earlier, who played football with him at Bowman High School and then again at Fayetteville State University, he was nice enough to talk to me about his memories. And, you know, I think like anybody involved in the situation, he wanted to know if, you know, where the money was going to go. Not that there's been any money, but, you know, I mean, that's always people's assumption. And, you know, what I was going to do. And it really had an impact on me because, you know, obviously I have a wife and a child to support and all of that, and I have a career to work on. But, you know, I also did this because I wanted to honor this memory that I had and that I think a lot of people had. And because it's such a forgotten memory, what I thought along the way was, what are things that I can do to sort of remind people of Sylvester Ritter and remind people of the Junkyard Dog? And Richard's wife is Kathy Johnson. She's an apostle, which I guess is a lot like a preacher. They've been building a church in Hickory, which is not too far from Charlotte, North Carolina, not too far from where they grew up in Wadesboro, North Carolina. It's called the GS Glory Church. It's a Christian church. They call it non-denominational. And, you know, I told him that if there was anything that I could do along the way, I would certainly help them make a donation or raise money for them. And, you know, it seemed like a good first step. You know, the statue seems a little daunting at this point in time to make political connections in New Orleans and get that done, but I do want to work my way up to it. But, you know, things like doing a gravestone, that takes family approval. Hopefully we can get that done as well. I think in the fall we'll probably try to start an account to raise some money for Fayetteville State University. They have a ring of honor. And I think absolutely that Sylvester Ritter should be in their ring of honor. He was a four-year starter at Fayetteville State. He played every position along the offensive line. He was a senior captain. He was 2 years all NAIA. And, you know, the hard part is he was an offensive lineman, so there's no stats that you can point to say, hey, he was a great player. But I talked to his coach. That was one of the people that I interviewed, and his coach said that he was just a high-quality individual, a great player, four-year starter, obviously, so of course he was a great player if he came in and started as a freshman. Mm-hmm. And no one could really tell me why he had not been inducted into the Ring of Honor. And a couple of people kind of said, and I think they were serious. It came off a little snarky, but, you know, I do believe they were genuine. They said, well, you know, maybe he didn't make donations when he was having success. Maybe he didn't give back to the athletic fund or something like that. So I think in football season we'll try to set up another account and get some donations to go to Fayetteville State University. But right now I thought that the church was a good place to start. It's such a good story in a way. It's good friends of his. They're building a church. I mean, you know, whether you're religious or not or spiritual or not, it's just a nice way that you could honor the Junkyard Dog. Again, it goes back to that story about the blinding angle and his fans sending in money to support his family because they really believed that, you know, the Junkyard Dog was going to have to find another career to support his new baby girl. And they would send a dollar, or they would send $5 or a $20 bill, you know. So I think that if there are people there that are remembering the Junkyard Dog and remembering how many times he put a smile on their face because he beat Ted DiBiase or beat Ernie Ladd or beat Terry Funk or whoever it was, you know, they could go to the website and donate a dollar in his name. And, you know, everything's going to go to the church except what Indiegogo takes out of the account, which is about 6-7%. Mm-hmm. We've got about 4 months to do it. I checked the other day. Unfortunately, nobody's donated yet, but we just started the account. So hopefully somebody will get on and get the ball rolling, donate a couple bucks. We're not asking for much. We're just asking if he made you smile. If you want to celebrate his life and donate in his name, to please do so. You know, one of the things that you mentioned is that I've submitted his name for induction into a couple of the Sports Hall of Fames, and so far we have not had any success with that. I've done it twice to Louisiana, once to North Carolina. I don't know if it's the pro wrestling aspect of it. You know, in Louisiana, he really doesn't qualify except as a pro wrestler.
Right.
In North Carolina, he should qualify as as a sports hero. The problem is he's an offensive lineman. So how do you tell them that he was a great offensive lineman? You know, so far it hasn't happened. There are no pro wrestlers in the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame, and Ric Flair being Ric Flair, you know, being a Charlotte icon, that pretty much tells me that if he's not in, they're not inducting pro wrestlers.
Yeah.
But because Sylvester Ritter played his high school and college ball in North Carolina, we at least have a shot. And I think that, you know, maybe if we build up his legacy a little bit, he will eventually get in there. Louisiana, you know, it's more of a questionable judgment. Ernie Ladd is in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame, so there's a little bit of gray area there. But Ernie Ladd was a legend in Louisiana as a high school football player and went to Grambling, where he was a legend as a college football player. So it's very possible that he was inducted for that and not for his pro wrestling.
Right.
So I don't know if it will happen in Louisiana or not. But, you know, like I said, I'm just looking for different ways that we can honor Sylvester Ritter and, you know, do some things, do some nice things for his fans and for his family and, you know, for his friends, so that, you know, even though he's been gone for 14 years and even though his wrestling career was over a few years before that, we can, you know, just do something nice and remember him.
Well, if you feel like helping out with this effort, again, that website is www.indiegogo.com/junkyarddog. We'll certainly post that on OWW and hopefully get some folks direct over to it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And people can also follow me at JYDBook on Twitter. We post a lot of stuff about old matches from Mid-South and old matches from the Junkyard Dog and, you know, some WWF and Georgia matches as well. And, of course, we'll be updating everything that goes on with the fundraising campaign and everything that's going on with the book, which is quite a lot at the moment, I'm happy to say.
Good. Well, I really wish we had more time to talk because there's some great stories in the book we didn't even get to. I love the parts about when he was Stagger Lee coming back wearing a mask. And just a lot of great material in there. Thanks again so much for joining me today, Greg, and congratulations on a very well-researched, well-written book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. I highly recommend people read The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Wrestling's First Black Superstar. And don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you were there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at OWW@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast or to report news about professional wrestling. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all the latest program updates and announcements. We will also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. Until next time, I am David. I hope you've enjoyed the program, and we'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio.